everybody, welcome back to the Dreamer's Edge podcast. I'm sitting with
Nicholas. I write video game reviews for thedreamersedge.com.
Eric, I mold minds for the future.
Chris, reader and sometimes writer.
And I'm Dimitri, webmaster of thedreamersedge.com and movie critic. So you've heard the best of the 70s, you've also heard the best of the 80s and then the aughts and the 90s, and you know by now that we're now going to do the worst of the 70s.
Well, first we need to say that, you know, when we talk about bad movies from the 70s, it's movies we should have seen. Not just, you know, oh, I read this is a horrible movie, so I'm going to put it in the list, you know.
Right.
So, with that rule in mind, it was pretty hard for me because I did not see a lot of movies, again, actively going to watch them. My first one is Moonraker. That one and The Spy Who Loved Me were pretty much the ones where they decided that James Bond wasn't a spy. It wasn't good enough to be a spy to stop, you know, plots for people who wanted extra money or NATO against the Soviet Union. In those, he had to kind of save the world against a maniac that wanted to repopulate the Earth with, yeah, perfect people because, you know, they looked nice or something. But Moonraker was just so memorable for that, you know, scene in space where they're fighting with lasers, like so reminiscent of Star Wars that came out like the same year or the year before, I forget. And it's just horrible and poor choice for a James Bond movie, really.
It's a Roger Moore one, right?
Yeah, it's a Roger Moore one.
With Jaws and, you know, like...
Jaws was the only redeeming part of that movie. He was awesome.
Yeah, he can survive one hell of a fall from very, very far.
From orbit, he can survive a fall from orbit.
I find it rare that we disagree on this section. So all I can say is, yeah. But, you know what I mean, in terms of the James Bond, you know, like, what is it, 31 films? I can't even remember now. Like, it's just ridiculous. But,
yeah.
But, they've got as many bad movies as good movies, you know, or if not... more bad movies than good movies in a way, you know, because they're all, like, really kind of campy and weird, you know, like, some of them are just too dated to really almost enjoy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you see, it was at the Sean Connery guy, and he has his earpiece, and the earpiece is sticking out. It's almost as if he has a double head, and he's trying very subtly to touch it, and he's like, the guy just came in. It's ridiculous. Especially when we look at now with the technology that's so small and sleek.
But the thing with Moonraker is that it was stupid even then. Like, we don't have to wait for time to pass.
As soon as it came out, it was ridiculous.
And despite Love Me, the year before, they had the same battle, except they were underwater shooting harpoons, and then they were in space shooting lasers, but it's the same exact fight. It's ridiculous.
All right, number two pick for worst movie of the 70s, Nick.
Star Trek, The Motion Picture.
Oh, that is a terrific pick. It did not even cross my mind. That was a great one.
With that bald chick.
Yeah, the bald chick that actually cried when they shaved her head. You can find the clip on YouTube of her getting shaved and then crying when she sees herself.
Really?
And Roddenberry trying to console her. But yeah, that movie, it's basically a 40-minute episode that they tried to extend with, like, nice special effect pieces of the ship moving or stuff like that.
It's also a really bad episode to begin with.
Yeah, exactly.
But the movies get better, like Graphicon and everything else. They actually get better.
They learned from their mistake.
Yeah.
But the first one, it's pretty much... They spent, like, I think 15 minutes in, like, the ship in a spiral because there's a problem with the warp core. And they're kind of acting in slow motion. You're watching this... And you cannot help but laugh because it looks so ridiculous. You know, they're trying to convey that they're in mortal danger, and it's like, this is ridiculous. And then they have to find V'ger, who is basically Voyager 7.
Spoiler alert!
I know, I'm sorry. And it's a miracle that the franchise survived that.
I love how you can tell by the way we approach our discussion of the movies how much respect we have from the movies. Soylent Green were like bending over backwards last week, 2 weeks ago, trying not to tell you what the punch is, even though everybody knows it.
Yeah, who cares?
Yeah, well, this one, we're trying to have people not watch it. So, yeah, this is the big spoiler.
The thing that kills me about Star Trek The Motion Picture is that it is so boring.
Yes.
It's nothing happened. It's like, I can't say that I find anything in it particularly stupid. Like, even the punch, it's sort of like, Yeah, it's kind of cute. But it's just, it takes forever to get there, and nothing happens in between the opening credits and that revelation. Yeah. It's brutal.
Yeah.
No, I agree. It's just, but I like your point. It's just, it's amazing that the franchise survived. You know what I mean? Because it had been a couple of years since it had been on television.
Yeah.
Then they reboot it, invest this money into it. Everyone's supposed to rush to the theater to kind of like get back with their buddies, you know?
Yeah, I know.
And then they give us this crap movie, you know what I mean? And it's true. Like, it's, in terms of space opera, if that's what it was, like, it doesn't have the highs and lows. It's just, like, banal. It's, like, across the whole thing, you know?
I think it's because the blockbuster machine hadn't yet been solidified and established that it managed to get a part two. People were still experimenting with the concept of sequels and franchise, yeah, and hadn't learned the lesson of, your first one's not going to sell, your second one's not going to sell either. They hadn't learned that, and therefore managed to break that rule, you know?
Yeah.
And number one.
Number one is Zardoz.
Oh, went for a classic right there.
Indeed. You know, I guess Sean Connery was tired of making popular James Bond movies, so he decided, you know, let's do this piece of crap.
To be Roger polite. Moore's not going to be the only one making bad movies.
Exactly. Which is basically the world in the future where you have barbarians and, like, smart people, and he's like a barbarian.
And with chess hairs.
Yeah, exactly. They're the barbarians. And he's working for Zardoz, and he's killing people, but he goes into the smart people world to, I don't know what he's trying to do there, really, because it's a giant mess.
That's the one with roller skates at some point, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And he's pulling a carriage with two people in them, and he's like a horse at one point. What is happening in this movie? Seriously.
I've never actually seen the whole thing. I've seen clips of it, of course.
Yeah.
You know, but, and I remember the video box, you know what I mean? Like, from back in my, like, hunting the video store days, you know? Thinking, like, this one must be cool. But no, I'll go for the barbarian movie that has, like, the painted cover.
Yeah, I confess I haven't sat through it in full either.
No, me neither. I fast-forward a bunch of things. I was doing other stuff, because, you know, it's...
You were the one on insisting on underlining the rule that we must have seen the movie.
I've seen 80 to 70% of it, to 60%.
80 to 70 to 60%. I was close in the house while it was playing.
Chris, you're three.
One of the things I mentioned before is, like, there's a certain type of storyline that I find you saw mostly in the 60s, you know what I mean? And this one carries through quite well into the 70s, that I really don't like. And so there's Mel Brooks, Blazing Saddles. I hate this movie with a passion.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
There's one or two scenes that are funny, but it's like watching The Party with Peter Sellers, or, you know what I mean? Like, one or two little moments are funny, but you're stuck there watching a two-hour movie with, like, basically written by 20 different people smoking drugs.
I sense a sort of continuity in your picks for worst movies. Like, you do not like that type of Mel Brooks humor.
I don't like sloppy storytelling. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even rambling. Like, you're not discovering more about the character through that type of thing.
No, it's props in the comedy.
It's just sketches stitched together to basically meet your 90 minutes. And I don't like that. And especially Blazing Saddles, it takes that to the extreme where it's just like, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and more ridiculous till the end. You know what I mean? It's just... So for me, yeah, I've watched it a couple times. It's been in the background in parties, you know, and you kind of, like, you turn over and you laugh at a few things. But to call it a good movie? No.
I gotta admit that Blazing Saddles always loses me at the end because of that escalation that you mentioned. And the minute they break the fourth wall, which is completely unnecessary, is when I throw my hands in the air and I just go, F you two movie. It's a visceral reaction I have every time, because I actually sort of am despite.
By the way, F you means fuck you.
Way to keep the clean rating.
Because despite all the jokes, I sort of get into it. I sort of get invested in some of the characters through the sketch comedy, and then at the end, because of the escalation, it's as if the movie turns on me for making that effort into getting attached to them.
For me, you know what I mean? Like, if it's going to be sketch comedy, keep it 20 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it didn't need to be a movie. You know
That's
what I mean?
A
like,
long sketch, man.
Well, yeah. Meaning, like, several sketches. You know what I mean? Like, you know. No, I don't know. Anyway, you know what I mean? I'm not going to justify it.
Yeah.
I stand by my hate. Number two, a movie that I feel gets a little bit more attention than I think it deserves, or attention that kind of just confuses me. Fritz the Cat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly?
That's a good one.
Fritz the Cat's a character based on cartoons by R. Crumb, who's famous for underground 60s LSD-inspired stuff.
Yeah.
And it's basically...
That sucked.
And it's done by the Ralph Bakshi studio. It's supposed to be a play up on the whole 60s counterculture movement. Oh, so there's some Black Panther stuff, there's, you know, some anti-war stuff, you know what I mean? But it's basically a young tomcat who discovers himself through women, sex, and drugs. Yeah. And it's kind of risque because it's done through film, you know?
Animation.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, like moving film. That's drawn. It's one of those things where it's just like, sometimes when I see something like this, it's just like, really? You probably invested 2 years of your life into like drawing these pictures, thinking that this story was important enough to like draw and film and invest in, and like, is it really?
I always resent these types of movies. I'm thinking of this movie,
Blazing Saddles.
Wizard, and even a little bit heavy metal, even though I kind of like heavy metal, but even that gets so much praise and a huge devoted cult following for being adult cartoons.
Well, exactly, when all adult means is I've shown some breasts and maybe there's some hyperviolence.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Adult means mature themes. And mature themes does not, again, you know, it means actually just a thinking person's story.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and especially if you compare, like, even if you want to take it adult in a almost more adolescent sort of interpretation of it, the Japanese with their anime has sort of evolved so far beyond that around the same time. You know, like, yes, we make the jokes about the tentacles and the power-ups and the silly things, but like, if you watch anime in its full spectrum, they have those great dramatic tales and these very human tales that address adults.
It's also the way that they view animation.
Exactly. Yeah.
They view it as film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They'll exactly like moving drawn pictures.
Exactly.
The pictures draw. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. But in Japanese anime, you do get these moments where you have like great establishing shots, like where, let's say, you get a swing set and you get the rain that's falling. Where most Americans' animation is not really going to draw that. It's like, oh no, we need to be silly, we need to have a song, we need to move on.
Yeah.
Here they're actually taking time to actually draw this to, no, look, we're setting something up here. So, very different.
As a result, though, when people, especially today, when people who have access to a global artistic pool, still celebrate movies like Fritz the Cat, it's sort of like, it feels a little bit like you're praising the slow kid in the class.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah. You know.
All right, Chris, number one pick for worst movie of the 70s.
Okay, and this one, it's by no means the worst, but I guess for me it's a disappointment, you know, and it's actually The Great Gatsby.
Oh, the movie.
Yeah, the Robert Redford film with
Will Ferrell. It's not good.
Eric, one of the things that you chose as one of your favorite films was All the President's Men. And one of the anecdotes about The Great Gatsby is apparently Robert Redford basically was so distracted through the filming. Every time there was a break, he wouldn't talk to the director, wouldn't talk to anyone. He would run back to his trailer just to watch the news breaking of the Watergate scandal, because he's a very politicized man, you know, and he was so stressed and worried about the whole thing, and basically a couple years later he acted on that film. So it's interesting that, you know what I mean, that thing is maybe a reason why he was just a bad actor in this movie, is what it comes down to.
I didn't notice him being particularly bad, but I will say about the film adaptation of The Great Gatsby, because of course, a new one.
With Leonardo DiCaprio.
And it's like, why? Because The Great Gatsby is a piece of literature. It is, to some extent, according to many, myself included, a near-perfect piece of literature. And its power derives from the way it's written, something that will not be translated into the screen.
Well, I think the reason it's always been a problem is because they've always just tried to make it as one movie, and I hear that now they're going to turn it into three films, and it's going to come out like every Christmas. Like The Hobbit. No, I'm joking.
Okay.
Wow.
God.
Yeah.
It's like one party per movie.
Yeah. There is so much story here that really...
But I don't mind art trying to interpret things. I don't mind, like, I think it's an incredible challenge to try to put the Great Gatsby on screen. But at the same time, like, if there's a director that wants to take the challenge, I don't think it should be like, oh, no, 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 you can't do that. That's
you can't touch this. This is classic.
No, no, no.
I think everything should be...
Yeah.
No, you have
to make
the point.
There is room to reinterpret. There is room to, okay, I'm going to tell this story in a different angle. Fine.
You make a good point. Certainly, when they adapted Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, it certainly felt how are you going to do this? But when I did see A Cock and Bull Story, I thought it was fantastic. But here's the thing, and the same thing with Wide Oleander. What they did is sort of take the spirit of it and sort of spin it in their own direction. That's what made it great. The thing with
I don't like the Harry Potter adaptation, because it's just like I'm watching the book.
And the thing with The Great Gatsby that you bring up is that they just followed the plot, and the plot of The Great Gatsby is not the point. And it's just like, why?
Yeah,
yeah. No, you've got to fist the hell out of that.
Mm.
All right, so I guess it's your turn now.
Oh, is it? Okay. Three picks for worst movies of the '70s, and there were a lot. But I decided for my third pick, I would do something different. I am going to name you a movie that definitely deserves to be on there, but that I kind of love. And that's a Japanese movie by the name of Houseu, 1977, or House, for those of you who don't speak Japanese, like me. And what it is, it's a haunted house movie filtered through the mind of a director who has no sense whatsoever. This movie is like cacophony. No scene sticks to the next. At one point, there's a piano that eats people and a leg that kung fu's its way out to save its owner. Somebody literally goes bananas at some point and screams, why not pineapples? Like, none of this movie is coherent, and yet it is absolutely compelling and creepy because you're looking at it and going, I can't believe that came out of someone's mind.
Was it made on purpose to be that way?
Because how did they get distributed here? That's my wondering. Was it appreciated there, and you know, or did someone just find it and think it was the funniest thing? Like, that would be an interesting like business story to kind of like who chose this, because you've got to curate imports. If you know what I mean, like, you know, you've got the. So who chose this, and of all the movies that you know we haven't seen, why do we have access to this one?
No, I mean the movie's got a Criterion edition, for God's sakes.
Really?
Yeah, it actually has a Criterion DVD for Houseu, a movie that is so bad it reaches awesome from the other end.
It's the Birdemic of its time.
Yeah, except Birdemic actually tells a story.
I see. Oh, wow.
Houseu sort of doesn't quite even get there.
Interesting.
Or The Room. Wait, is that the one?
Oh, the Tommy Wiseau one?
Yeah.
We're not allowed to talk about it. Tommy Wiseau will sue.
You just mentioned it. We didn't.
That's true, that's true, that's true. We didn't review it. Good, good, good.
Yeah.
Tommy Wiseau's The Room exists. All right, I guess I'm going to move on to number two.
Yes.
Number two, worst movie of the 1970s. Something that more people might have seen, but it's still from Asia, sort of. The Game of Death, 1978 Bruce Lee movie.
Really?
Yes. I'm putting Bruce Lee in my worst movies of the 70s. Come on, write your letters, people.
Is that the one where he has the yellow jumpsuit?
Yes, it is the one where he has the yellow jumpsuit.
And he battles the basketball star?
Yes, that's the one.
Are you serious? I kind of like that film. I know it's kind of like a video game, like he goes from one stage to the other, but... Mm-hmm.
Look, video games back then were not that way. It was like...
That's true. If it were a video game back then, it would be Bruce Lee would be a paddle, and the basketball player would just be throwing balls at each other.
Yeah, I kind of liked it. Well, from what I remember, I was a child, like watching it, and then I was just like, "Wow, kung fu's cool."
Oh, yeah, the kung fu fights are fantastic. I can tell you with absolute certainty that exactly 30 minutes of the film is sheer awesomeness. The reason I can tell you that is because Bruce Lee filmed exactly 30 minutes of this movie before passing away. And then years later, they cobbled together a story out of the movie using stunt actors wearing masks, wearing sunglasses, and whatnot to pass for Bruce Lee.
You think if they had made the movie, the rest of the movie, without using Bruce Lee fighting, and it just kept the 30 minutes of him fighting, you know, for example, and then made a story without him?
Isn't it ironic they did the same thing for his son?
Well, at least his son with Brandon Lee, they finished most of the movie. It was just a few running scenes in the background, and he kept the shots far away. It was just him getting, like, all the actual acting parts were done, you know? But the thing about, you mentioned, would it have been better if they had done 30 minutes? I would even have taken if they had done a movie that's unrelated to Bruce Lee with flashbacks to this perfect warrior from 2 years ago.
Remember that time.
Because the thing with Game of Death is that they wrote the plot after. Like, I can forgive The Crow for everything because it follows the plot that was already established. They wrote the plot after, and the plot they chose for it is, and I'm reading this from IMDb, a martial arts movie star must fake his death to find the people who are trying to kill him. Now, given that Bruce Lee actually died for real, did it not occur to anyone that that was in tremendous poor taste? Exactly.
That's horrible.
Yeah. That's what angers me about the movie. It's not the movie itself so much as the context of it. And it's like this is exploitation taken to a completely new level. This is supposed to be Bruce Lee's final movie. And it's a movie that practically spits on his grave.
It's pretty cheap.
Number one pick for worst movie of the 70s, according to moi. And this one, I think most people will agree, The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, 1977.
I hate The Exorcist.
Oh, I want to hear why.
I don't like horror films. I'm not a big fan of the genre. Call me a chicken, but it's just, for me, whenever I see a horror film, there's no story. It's just about frightening me, and I'm kind of like, eh. I find something frightening is something creepy. Like, for me, that's actually going to say more than having somebody that's like, I'm the Exorcist. Okay, yeah, it's frightening, but it doesn't stay as long.
Well, I find The Exorcist actually does satisfy that creep factor because it plays into some taboos.
I don't have that. Religious beliefs,
you know what I mean? So, you know what I mean? I know people who were pregnant when they went to go watch it, you know what I mean? Like, one of my friends, you know, was pregnant with her daughter. And, like, she was just freaked out. She was just, like, it freaked her out. She had to go to the priest the next day. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, for whatever reason, it was just one of those movies that kind of, like, just tapped into some kind of, like, reminded you of some Bible stories and stuff. You know?
That story is more interesting to me as you're telling it, but when I see the film, I'm like, But that's the thing. I don't like horror films. I can't relate to it. I just find it kind of boring.
Well, would it have helped you relate to the movie if it featured self-hypnosis machines that allow you to travel into different dreams, lots of moth, and a demon called, I kid you not, a Zuzu, so that the characters can scream while shaking their fists in the air continuously, a Zuzu! A Zuzu! While trying to scare you.
Do you have it here?
I have the Criterion edition.
I actually do have it, by the way, because I bought the Transistors box set.
And you didn't throw the disc away? Like, I just want the first one. Screw this.
Isn't that the coaster? No, I might have seen it, you know what I mean? Like, because there was certainly that period in my life where you'd rent a bunch of, like, horror movies and watch them in your friend's basement, you know what I mean? Like, so it might have been one of those movies, but, like, it's just they've blended in, and I've never revisited it, so.
Well, for the benefit of the listeners who might have seen it, the problem with The Exorcist 2 is that the first one was drew most of its power from being relatable. It was just this monoparental family struggling, well, you know, they were rich, but still struggling with just, you know, the mother raising her kid, faced with a problem that might well be mental illness and not knowing what to do with it. She takes the daughter to the doctor, all that. What's powerful about this movie is that she does all the right things instead of doing the horror movie.
Or maybe it's really about a mother whose child is becoming a teenager and she can't really understand her anymore.
See, that would have been an interesting movie if I had taken that angle. Absolutely. But it wasn't where they went with it. They went the Exorcist route, justifying the title. But the power of it is that it was relatable. The scariest scenes are not the spinning heads and vomit everywhere. There are scenes like when Regan, the poor little girl, 13-year-old girl, doesn't know what's happening to her and is stuck in this big machine that goes putum, 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 and you feel how scary it must be for her to feel like she's losing her mind and to feel that the solution is to go through these horrible machines that seem to be as violating to her as anything else. You know, those are the powerful moments in that movie. The Exorcist 2 just went like, nah. And moved her away into a big high rise. Like, the sets are completely unbelievable. She gets therapy into a science fiction room with glass windows, with little helmets that she puts on so that people can go into her dreams. Like,
what?
Yeah. No, that's ridiculous. And again, it gets flashbacks to a demon that is not a Christian demon, which Americans can relate to right away, but an African demon with a name like Azuzu, which again makes me laugh.
I'm sure a bunch of Africans listening to us right now aren't laughing at Azuzu.
Well, it's interesting because the 70s was one of the first decades where they were, you know what I mean, like doing sequels. And here's one that's just like, obviously just like, did not understand the spirit of the first one at all.
Yeah, Eric, exactly. Your picks.
Yeah, I don't have three. As I said, I kind of drew a blank as far as, you know, trying to find films that I watched that I found horrible. There was one that to this day I don't like and might be unpopular. Superman. I hate that film.
Why is Frank not here?
I know.
Why is Frank not here?
He would probably freak out. Oh my god!
I will try and channel Frank.
Frank sounds a lot like Nick Nolte.
I thought Christopher Reeve was actually really good. Yeah.
What I like about Christopher Reeves, what I like the most is when he plays Clark Kent. I hate him as Superman.
Really?
I loved him as Clark Kent. I thought he was actually more charming and engaging and bumbling, and I was like, I love this character. I want to see another film with just him as Clark Kent. That would be the film that I'd be more interested in. Whenever he has like the suit and everything and he's flying about, I'm like, meh, whatever. It left me indifferent. And even Gene Hackman, whom I love.
I don't like him in As Lex Luthor. I never did either.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually like Kevin Spacey more.
Yeah, me too.
Interesting.
Okay, I do feel, though, that we should all have a top three in this episode, Eric. So I'm going to make one for you. Top three reasons why you're wrong about Superman, Eric. Number three. I love Christopher Reeves, actually, as Superman. I think one of the greatest thing he achieves in that movie that very few other actors have, certainly not Brandon Routh, although he's not a bad actor, it's just he didn't really work for me as Superman, is that, yeah, like you said, he's quite likable as Clark Kent, but he's also really uncharismatic and sort of... he's not just playing a nerd, he's playing this sort of guy that's very easy to ignore. And then when he dons the Superman suit, which is the goofiest looking thing ever, he convinces me that this guy is grander than life. He convinces me that this dude you would not mess with, you'd respect, you'd like, and it's he does it all with charisma. And I find that amazing.
He's likable, but didn't really do it for me. And even I know I can almost see the wires as he's like, you know, fist in the air. Here I am flying.
As he's fisting the air. Heard it first on theirresearch.com, folks.
The air liked it.
Alright, number two, because you just mentioned this. The tagline of the Superman posters and the entire commercial strategy was all about, you will believe a man can fly. And honestly, despite the clunky special effects that were the limitations of the time, I did believe a man could fly when I watched Superman.
Is it because the cape kind of moved?
No, it's because they set up a universe where it would be so awesome if a man could fly and sort of build up to that moment that it would be really awesome if a man could fly, that by the time that the man did fly, I really wanted to believe in it. And I think that's what Donner does so well, that like we talked in the previous episodes about how today's movies, Nick, you brought that up, that we sort of just rely on just stock cliches and establishing the characters. Well, you will like it. You will accept the rules of this universe. Superman actually takes the time of sort of building you up so that you willingly take that suspension of disbelief. And I think that's a really powerful thing about Richard Donner's Superman. Yeah, I think the ending is super stupid. I think the beginning drags and I just sort of want to shoot myself. But the way it builds up my desire for a man to fly, I thought was super effective.
Okay.
And number one reason why you're wrong, I love the dynamic with Lois Lane.
I was going to say that. She's the big thing for that one. I wouldn't have pictured her as Lois Lane. You know what I mean? Like I picture Lois Lane as like
the Terry Hatcher.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Like just you know a little bit more poised. I don't know. You know what I mean. Like a professional. You know, and the Lois Lane in this one is like a little bit scatterbrained, kind of like and manic. You know what I mean. Like and just like really interested. You know, and much more believable as a character. You know.
And she's not super pretty. No. I love that they picked a leading lady, which was already rare at the time, that sort of looked like an ordinary woman.
Yeah.
And I love that. And their sort of double entendre when she's interviewing Superman, it's like, I can't believe kids were allowed to watch this back in the day because all they do is talk about sex throughout the movie. Whenever Lois Lane and Superman are talking to each other, they're all only talking about fucking. That's all they do. But it's fun. It's funny. It's interesting. And, like, that for me carries a movie past its clunky idea.
Sex is fun? What's wrong with you?
Well, I imagine sex is fun.
Sometimes when I'm out there, fist in the air.
And so if you want to write us, share with us your worst experiences with movies from the 70s, please write us at mail@thedreamersedge.com or you can post a comment at thedreamersedge.com. We're also on Facebook, we're also on Twitter, we're also on iTunes. In fact, if you can, write us a review on iTunes. We love the feedback and the attention. We're attention whores, is what we're saying. That's what we're saying. Yep. And
we're kind of drunk right now, so.
Yeah, says the one guy who hasn't been drinking.